right, welcome to a special episode of Piecing It Together, the podcast where we take a look at a new movie and try to figure out what movies inspired it. But today on the show, we are doing something that we have never done before here on Piecing It Together, 100-something episodes in. We've done a bunch of special episodes here and there. We, of course, did our Oscar predictions. We have done special follow-up episodes on a particular movie. We've done Breaking It Aparts, which are backwards episodes. And we've done interview episodes. We've done a bunch of different kinds of specials, but this is something new. So we have this Facebook group called Popcorn and Puzzle Pieces, where we continue the conversation about all the movies we talk about on the show. And of course, Quentin Tarantino's Once Upon a Time in Hollywood has come up many, many times over the past year since it came out this past summer, and then has been a big part of the conversation leading up to this weekend's Oscars. And when is a Tarantino movie not a big part of the conversation? Always, of course. But one thing that we've noticed is that the opinion on this movie, it's not just a matter of good or bad, love it or hate it, or any of that kind of thing. It is love it or loathe the movie. I mean, just absolutely think it's terrible. And it just so happens two of our many time returning co-hosts are on complete opposite ends of the spectrum. We've got Joe Black, who is actually the co-host on our main episode about Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, which if you haven't listened to, you should pause this and go listen to and then come back to this. But Joe loved it. And then on the other end of the spectrum is Chad Clinton Freeman, who absolutely hated it. It's his least favorite Tarantino movie. I think it was his dead last on his ranking of all the movies he saw last year. He hated this movie. So it was proposed, I'm not sure which one of them, I think it was Joe at first, and then we were going to let it slide for a while, then Chad was like, we should do that. And so here we are, we're finally doing it. It was proposed that we have a conversation that I moderate of the two of them stating their case for why it's a great movie, why it's a bad movie. So we are going to go back and forth. We got a whole bunch of points to hit, and we're going to have a great long conversation about why this movie is great, why this movie is bad. It is an interesting thing to talk about and to do it in this way. I think it's something we should do again in the future. It was a lot of fun. I do want to say, though, that we had quite a few connection issues while we were recording this one. It's an early morning recording, and I don't know, something's in the air, and it gave us quite a bit of trouble. So there may be some issues sound quality-wise here and there, especially towards the end of the episode. But I think I did a pretty good job of cleaning it all up, so it's not going to get in the way too much. So sit back, relax, enjoy this conversation. Like I said, make sure you've listened to our regular main episode, getting into the puzzle pieces and inspirations of Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. And if you've already listened to that and seen the movie, then I think you're going to really enjoy this conversation. All right, so with us today, we've got two people from completely different ends of the Once Upon a Time in Hollywood spectrum. We got one person who loved it, that is returning co-host Joe Black, and one person who hated it, that is returning co-host Chad Clinton Freeman. Joe, Chad, how you guys doing?
I'm tired.
I am great. I'm tired too.
I'm dragging these two out of bed to have a battle. An early morning battle.
Chad has the advantage. It's almost lunchtime over there.
That's true. Chad, you should have had yourself your coffee already. Nice little breakfast. What's going on here?
But for me, see, 10 a.m. Is not 10 a.m. probably for you. I was telling Dave earlier that I usually sleep till like 4 p.m. on a Wednesday because I'm off. So yeah, it's pretty early.
Oh boy. I feel like I'm just making you do these awful things for the sake of podcasting, for good quality content. So we're today going to, of course, talk about Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, a movie that Joe was the co-host on when we did the episode a few months back. And Chad was supposed to be on it, but he had to have an emergency eye surgery. How's your eye doing, Chad?
Oh, I'm doing a lot better. Yeah.
Okay, so good. That's good to hear. But once this movie came out, I mean, what Tarantino movie doesn't have controversy around it? But, you know, one of the things with this movie is it seems that a lot of people love it and a lot of people just absolutely hated it, and hated it for reasons that the people on the other side don't really seem to even recognize for the most part, and like think that they're complete non-issues. And it's made a really weird back and forth around this movie, going into the Oscars coming up this weekend, which is of course nominated for a few things. And I think has a chance to win some stuff. But even, you know, with aside from that, just in the regular conversation around the movie, there's so much back and forth and so many different sides. And so I think you two are going to really, you know, really represent those mm-hmm. sides in a really great way. I want to get started, though, with initial thoughts, what you thought of the movie when you got out of the theater, when you finished seeing it for the first time. Let's start with you, Joe. You were already on an episode about the movie, but let's tell people what you thought about it.
The first time I saw the movie, I didn't know what to make of it. It was, you know, I said on the episode, Tarantino, his movies, they're usually very thematically driven, but they're all genre movies, war movies, westerns, what have you. So he knows how to hit those genre beats very satisfactorily. And this was the first Tarantino movie that was not a genre film. So there were no typical beats to hit satisfactorily. And and this was completely thematically driven. There was no story. So I didn't really know how to take it in. And it wasn't until the third time that I absolutely fell in love with it. Once I understood what kind of film he was making, and I was able to navigate it under his terms, and by the third go round, I was just head over heels in love with it.
And Chad, what about you?
I was extremely disappointed. That was my reaction, was disappointment. I was really, really looking forward to this movie all year long, and then it didn't satisfy my want for a Tarantino movie, and it did not do what I felt it should have done. I feel like it sets up a ending that we should get, and then it doesn't deliver that ending. And I feel like it just does a lot of things very, very wrong that I don't feel Tarantino necessarily was intending to do.
What kind of ending? Mm-hmm. What kind of ending do you feel it was setting up?
Well, I feel like that the movie totally sets up an ending that should see Rick with Sharon and Bruce Lee going to the compound and actually killing Charles Manson. That's the ending that I wanted. That's the ending it would totally, like, that's where, and Pussy. Pussy is the other character. I feel like that you've set up these characters that are going to give us something that we don't get. That's what I feel.
You wanted it to flip the history in a way that it sets up these new characters as heroes that go and change history in a very specific way.
Yeah, but it, specifically, I feel like that you've got characters that go nowhere otherwise. I mean, what's the point of Bruce Lee being in the movie? There's no reason at all. I think he purposely throws him in there expecting you to want that ending, and then he doesn't give it to you. And to me, I was unhappy with that. So
I guess I can see where you're coming from, Chad. And by the way, I failed to mention at the top of this, I definitely fall in the love side of things. So I'm going to try to be as impartial as possible in moderating this. But I see where you're coming from. But of course, I think it's the movie is about these main characters and not about, you know, the whole Manson thing and getting, you know, revenge on Manson or whatever, which is what I think a lot of people thought it was going to be going into it in the first place.
I'd say it is, though. I mean, because the last half of the film is just a brutal bloodbath of, you know, killing hippies. So
the trailer itself definitely sets you up for a more Manson heavy movie. And you know, but that's marketing's fault. You can't hold that against the movie. But I don't agree with the idea that Bruce Lee serves absolutely no purpose in the movie either. I think that from what it sounds like, before you even saw this movie, you had an idea in your head of what you wanted the movie to be. And I mean, a movie not being what, I don't know, a movie being something other than what you wanted it to be doesn't mean it's not a great film. And I find the ending, you described the ending of the movie as a bloodbath, but I don't think, again, I don't think that that's the point. I think that there are other things at play that are, you're just kind of not paying attention to, or that you're ignoring. You know, the first line of the film that Rick has is in a clip from his show Bounty Law. And the first line, somebody says to him, he says, "Geez, Rick, do you ever take them in alive?" And Rick says, "Not when there's three of them and one of me." You know, and it's not a coincidence that at the end of the film, they take out three of Manson's cult, and that it's Rick's stuntman who does all the hard work, and then Rick himself is the one who gets the money shot and all the glory from it. There's a lot of stuff like that going on in the movie, and that's why I think that repeat viewings are necessary for a movie like this, especially when you come into it like I did, bringing all of your Tarantino baggage as well. This isn't a revenge fantasy like Inglourious Basterds or Django Unchained. That's not what this is.
I mean, I totally agree that you know, your expectations of a film, if a movie doesn't necessarily meet them, doesn't make it a bad film. But what I feel is this movie just one. I feel the whole Bruce Lee scene, I feel it takes a lot of viewers out of the movie completely, because I feel it's a bad caricature of Bruce Lee. And the fact that Brad Pitt, his character, beats Bruce Lee up is just totally laughable. And I feel that, you know, making it a fantasy scene, you know, it's a flashback or whatever. So it's obviously in, you know, Cliff Booth's mind. It still, it doesn't fix it for me. It totally throws me out of the movie. I think this did this for a lot of people.
Well, but why not though?
Because I mean, I think it's
why doesn't that set up context for you?
I think it's just a bad representation of Bruce Lee, and I think it's a bad I feel like it's, you know, it's pretty much a racist representation,
right? From an aging cowboy who was in the Korean War. From somebody who doesn't like the guy. And then the next two times you see Bruce Lee in the film, he's warm and loving and helpful and informative. And, you know, like, but from this guy's point of view, that's who Bruce Lee was, because he doesn't like him.
Right. But again, that's the problem with the movie altogether. It is from the point of view of angry white man who can't control what's going on. And to me, I think,
who gets lost in obscurity in time.
But it's hard for me. Okay, I'm okay with people being righteous in films, but I have a problem when it's white men. I don't know why, but I do. That doesn't work for me. And I think that if you look at Tarantino's movies, when he has righteous people, the two movies I do not like are Inglourious Basterds and this one. I'm totally cool with the righteous people of, I mean, you know, Pulp Fiction, obviously it's Jules. With Django, it's obviously, Django is the one, though, that is the hero. It just, there's something about this film of it being from the perspective of an angry, aging white man. It seems very pro-Trump in so many ways. It seems very anti-liberal, it seems anti-hippie.
Okay, so a couple things to that. One, I'm curious to know what you think of Inglourious Basterds, but two, Brad Pitt's character in the film, that's the bait and switch of the whole film. He's the person who cannot who cannot function in the way that society is changing. He can't bring himself to do it. And at the end of the film, he's like stuck in his ways, and he's the one being taken off to the hospital by minorities. One of the few minorities we see in the film. He's not able to adapt to change. And Rick is. And that's why Rick succeeds and Cliff is forgotten. No matter how quote unquote cool Cliff Booth can be, like he resents women. He resents Bruce Lee. That thing doesn't make sense to him. He is like the typical Norman Rockwell American. He is an actual cowboy. And the way that the landscape, cultural landscape is changing, there is no room for Cliff Booth anymore, because he's not able to adapt with the times. That's the whole point of his character in the movie.
But he's the hero still. I mean, it's you're supposed to be cheering him on of killing these guys and these women.
No, but first of all, these women characters, the idea of the Manson family is that they weren't hippies, and that this new idea of really the whole film. Okay. The whole film is about how the masculine has to embrace the feminine for there to be progress, for things to be better. That's what the whole movie is about. And how the Manson family stalled that progress because a conservative America that wasn't willing to adapt to the feminine used them as an excuse for all hippies, when they weren't even really hippies. They were their own creepy little cult brand thing. And the idea of why the murders are so violent in the film actually has very little, next to nothing, to do with the revenge fantasy for what they did in real life to Sharon Tate. It has everything to do with Cliff Booth's resentment of women and of changing culture that he himself can't adapt to. Like, it's not a coincidence that his wife was a total bitch, and after did he or didn't he kill her, the only woman in his life is an actual bitch, a female dog, right? And that his manly need to provide and care for somebody, like the quote unquote typical, you know, male point of view, the only person in his life who can facilitate that is Rick, who is another man, because Cliff Booth resents women. But Rick is more connected with his emotions, is actually has feminine qualities that he is in denial about, that Rick is in denial about. And by the end of the film, once Rick has like grown his hair long and is dressing a little more Italian and embracing a woman, his next door neighbor, like, that's when Rick succeeds.
I find all of that really, really interesting. Because I, to be honest, I hadn't quite looked at some of those angles of it yet. Like, a lot of that is stuff that is some of the reasons why I've loved this film, but some of it was kind of fresh and new to me. I'm curious, Chad, had you considered any of that in your analysis of the movie?
Yeah, well, exactly. And that, I mean, that's exactly why I don't like the film, though. Because, okay, I feel that the film, exactly, the Manson murders, they were not hippies, but I feel that the film portrays them as being hippies. I feel that the perspective of the film is very anti-woman. It is very anti-hippie. It's very anti-change. It's very macho man saves the day. You know, white man with a gun, white man with the fist. Conquers all, and that's what's so offensive about it, that it is an anti-change movie as opposed to embracing change. I mean, if I don't feel it works the way that it's intended to work, or at least it doesn't for me, and I think there are a lot of people that it doesn't work for. To me, it comes off as being sexist. It comes off as being racist. It comes off as being just mean and hateful.
You're certainly not alone in your opinions here, Chad.
Well, when is the first time in the movie that Leonardo DiCaprio's character Rick sees Sharon Tate? Do you remember?
I do not remember exactly.
It's when he and Cliff come home, and at the end of the first day in the film, and Roman Polanski and Sharon Tate pull up in the driveway next to him. Now, Leo is looking at Polanski, but his view is blocked by Sharon Tate, like laughing, and like she, and he's like looking around her, and he says to Cliff Booth, "Oh man, do you know who that is? That's Roman Polanski. He could actually be the key to my comeback. You know, if I get invited over there for one Polanski party, then my career could be back on track." He's literally looking past Sharon Tate, like he's looking through her to Roman Polanski. He doesn't even acknowledge her. But at the end of the film, who is it that actually embraces him and opens the gates to him and brings him over to that house, literally opening the gates to his future? It's Sharon Tate, like something he never even like understood as being like the key to a brighter future, the feminine, because he was too busy focusing on the male side of things, because that's how things were, you know. And again, after he does that performance on Lancer, when the director of Lancer is saying what he wants for his character's look, all he talks about is a big Zabata like mustache, right? They never mention anything about the hair. And then they reference the mustache a few times, even saying, "Hey Rick, make sure you don't eat when you're wearing that mustache, cause the glue's not dry." Like this idea that you literally can't take in nourishment with this overarching male thing in the way, right? Without ruining it. But Rick also has long hair. And then when Rick goes overseas, gets a more European sensibility, gets a wife, he comes back, his hair is longer, his clothes are more feminine, he's more brighter. He is embracing the feminine. And there is no more room for Cowboy Cliff Booth because he's embracing the feminine. And when he kills the final Manson girl, the first thing he says is, "Oh God, Francesca." Like he's concerned about his wife. Like, it's not there, and it's not glaringly obvious. There are some certain things that are more subtle than others, like at the beginning when they walk in the direction of the bathroom and not women. But
I don't think that works though, because I mean, Leo's the one that pulls out the flamethrower and torches, you know, one of these dirty hippie women. So I mean, to me that doesn't work. I mean, Sharon Tate's character embraces him because he's the hero. He's the macho masculine male again. So it just doesn't work for me.
Well, here's the thing. So you say that Leo is the hero, but here's the thing. We have been shown clearly that he's not. And Tarantino very brilliantly makes the murders brutal. They're not fun. It's not cool. It's unwatchable how violent and angry they are. He knows how to make a fun splatter fest. See Django, see Kill Bill, see. But this is like, you don't want to look at what's going on here. It's horrific. It's horrible. And
right.
And exactly. So we know that Rick is no hero.
This is all. And there's been some really interesting stuff in here so far. I want to make sure to touch on a few other points though that we haven't really talked about. And you just brought up the Sharon Tate, the walk, and all that. One of the big criticisms of the movie that we haven't touched on yet is Margot Robbie not having enough lines, that the character doesn't have enough to do. Chad, obviously you are more critical of this movie, so I want to hear from your end first what you think about this particular grievance.
I this is one of the big disappointments of this film, because I think you know, Margot Robbie is a fantastic actress when she is given things to do and when she is actually given a chance to act. It's funny because this whole Jim Carrey thing, of course, I posted about it. So, you know, Jim Carrey had the joke about how basically that she obviously has a lot of talent because of the way she looks. He's basically saying that she's a pretty face and she's gotten to where she is by being pretty. And I feel that the only two directors that have cast her in that way, disappointingly, is Martin Scorsese, Wolf of Wall Street, and then this film. I feel like that Tarantino and Scorsese have just thrown her in the films to be eye candy. I don't feel that Sharon Tate is given anything to do. I feel like it's not a good I think she's just there to, she's portrayed as ditzy. She's portrayed as, here, look at her pretty feet. Here, look at her pretty face. And that's it. I mean, there's not anything to the character. Again, had this character actually done something in the film, had there been an ending where you redeem Bruce Lee's character, you bring Sharon Tate's character in, make her a heroic figure that's along with Rick's character, actually does something like get rid of, Charles Manson himself, not necessarily slaughter, his followers, but like take Charles Manson out. You've got a totally different movie. And that's the movie I wanted to see.
So that, again, that goes back to it being such a different movie than what you expected versus what it actually ended up being. But Joe, what do you have to say about some of that?
I think it's hilarious because Sharon Tate, the whole point of her character in the movie is that she gets to live. Like, it's kind of a play on the expectation of the ending that, like, we all wish Sharon Tate had lived, like, in real life. This is, this movie is allowing Sharon Tate to live. And it treats her, at first, when we first meet her, it treats her as what she was at the time, which was, like, ogled by men and the wife of Roman Polanski. She wasn't her own, like, individual person. Right. And throughout the movie, her, like, she becomes, in her living day to day when she's on her own, she gives somebody a ride. She goes and has a discussion about books. She goes and sees one of her films and she gets to live in the glory of her accomplishments in that scene. The people are enjoying her film. And then they also show that, like, they use Bruce Lee again to show that, like, her dedication and commitment to something as silly as that movie, you know, she trained with Bruce Lee to get it right. The movie gives Sharon Tate her due as a person, as opposed to as the murder victim and the wife of Roman Polanski, or just like the sex symbol that they were making her out to be. She spends most of her day not sexualized. Mm. And not like, I mean, that's very calculated. It's, you know, when at the end of the film, do you know what the last time is when we see Sharon Tate? It's when she changes into her night clothes. The last scene with Sharon Tate, she's actually not even on camera, right? Like, it's Emile Hirsch talking to her off camera, looking away, looking at the past, basically. Like it creates the last real moment with Sharon Tate is solidifying her as a memory, as opposed to a functioning character in the film. And that's the love letter to Sharon Tate. It's not only, you know, it actually turns her into a real person, this movie. It treats her as something other than like some kind of like Hollywood, you know, blowhard and or sex symbol. She's the one person who is completely comfortable being herself in the film and not being the expectation that everyone else has of her.
Mm-hmm.
Like, how you see that is like just treating her as a sex symbol. I find that to be a really kind of, I don't even know how to describe that. Like this idea that she doesn't, you know, kill Charles Manson. Well, why would Sharon Tate be involved in that? You know, she was a real person. To not treat her like a real person, I think that would be way more disrespectful than not giving her a whole ton of lines, as they say.
That seems to be a thing throughout movies in general right now, is complaining about the amount of lines certain actors get, especially actresses.
Like Irishman.
I'm on board that argument because I totally agree. I think that especially, I mean, that's the thing, is that I feel like this movie kind of represents Martin Scorsese in that way, that he is Cliff Booth. And that's, again, that's my thing with this movie is that like, I feel like that this movie is almost like trying to take that back and say like, no, we are relevant, when I'm just like, no, just give it up. I mean, a change or give it up. And that's my thing with Scorsese. It's like, you know, move forward or, you know, stop making the sausage fest, gangster films. It's like, move forward.
Well, so. Chad, I just want to ask you, obviously I'm on the other side of this, but I want to ask you, I know you're a huge, huge Tarantino, fan. Do you really think that is the point of view Tarantino made this movie from?
Okay. This is my thing with this film, is that the way I view this film, I don't think is how he intended the film to come out. I don't think he intended viewers to see it this way. I don't think that he, just looking at what he's done, I don't feel that was in his intent, but I feel that that's how the movie comes off. So regardless of the art stands for itself, and you have to take it the way that, you know, you take it. And so regardless of his intent with the film, I think that that's something that he himself should look at. But I know that he won't at all, because he's one of those, and all great filmmakers are, you know, they don't do wrong necessarily. I mean, I would say that this film definitely pissed me off in a lot of ways and made me angry. And I would say that somebody like Tarantino would be happy with that, because it did evoke, you know, a strong emotion. So,
but I think the problem with this quote unquote woke culture is that it's so reactionary that it's getting in its own way. Like, nobody's willing to have a discussion. Nobody's willing to like people are just so upset, and I'm not necessarily following them for being upset, but like, they're just so reactive, and they get as close-minded as the people that they're arguing against. Like I don't, how many times have you seen this movie, Chad?
Oh, I've just seen it once. I'll never watch it again.
Right. So see, that's the problem. Like, no, I mean, if you're going to have an opinion, especially one as strong as that, art of all places is the safe space to navigate those ideas and themes. So again, if you're just reacting to like your gut reaction of something, most times when we hear something we don't want to hear or see something we don't want to see, it's jarring and it's upsetting and it throws us, and it's something that we actually have to process. And by throwing up your arms and saying absolutely not, and by just ignoring it and pretending like it didn't happen because it made you so upset, that is the worst possible thing that you can do. Because all this stuff is in the film. The film is designed that way. And you are already coming at it with your expectation of what a Tarantino film is. So, like, you know, again, you have such a strong opinion on something that you've decidedly not chosen to explore. And you dare say that Tarantino failed or that he should have done something different, when you haven't given it your efforts. You gave it a chance, but you didn't give it thought.
Oh, I've given it thought. I've given it a lot of thought. And my argument on that is that, you know, I mean, there are many things that I personally embrace and love that others do not give the time of day of. So why should I give things that don't appeal to me the time of day? So
here's the, well, I have a really strong answer for that. Two things. One, I don't believe in living a life based on the things that, like, just because somebody does you wrong, I don't think that like that justifies you doing wrong. I think that to be passionate about something is to do what you feel is right, not to bear resentments, not to hold resentments like that. But secondly, you know, you being somebody who I've seen, you know, your Batman versus Superman thing. I mean, I'm right there with you. I thought that was the best movie of 2016, probably for different reasons than what you did. But like, how much does it frustrate you when people are willfully ignorant about it? You know what I mean? Like when people don't listen to reason. And there's a difference between you having an opinion and somebody denying what the content of a film is. And so I don't see why you would take that road on this movie.
Well, it's just, again, you know, if something is unpleasant, then why should I experience it again? If something to me just feels wrong, why should I do it again? So, I mean, I've only seen Inglourious Basterds once. I saw it at the theater too. It was my least favorite Tarantino movie until this.
Why? That's interesting though. Like, why was Inglourious Basterds your least favorite?
It's just very, it's very high and uppity. It's very righteous. It's very, it's a very meta film in a lot of ways. I feel like that it's almost a commentary on Tarantino's career in one way. And it's almost as if he purposely revisits Jackie Brown, and he revisits Reservoir Dogs, and I felt like the movie was a joke to him personally. And then, you know, with the whole Brad Pitt character at the end saying, "Hey, this is my masterpiece," it's just like so, just like hokey,
okay,
and so just over the top. And the fact that Tarantino thinks that he can rewrite history, I think I have a problem with that. I don't know what the problem is, but I think I do have a problem with that.
When it comes to Inglourious Basterds, his whole commentary is that America in its own mind has rewritten history about its significance in World War II. Like the whole movie, Inglourious Basterds, is anti-propaganda. Like in all forms, like that's the whole point of Inglourious Basterds, that like in the movie, they're watching the movie Nation's Pride. It's a bunch of Nazis watching a movie about a Nazi, like, and it's just relishing in the defeat of the enemy. That's what Inglourious Basterds is. That's the whole point. Tarantino drew the parallel between us Americans, modern day Americans, and Nazis. Like he humanized Nazis instead of us treating them like big goblin golems. And he made us relate to them. What he's doing with Inglourious Basterds is what Goebbels was trying to do with Nation's Pride. And Tarantino draws that line very clearly at the end of the film, that America is its own evil propaganda machine, and that's what's led us in the wrong direction. And that's the point of Inglourious Basterds. Again, you've missed the point of Inglourious Basterds because you've chosen to only take it in once. But it's a real piece of art disguised as entertainment, and so to have such a vocal strong opinion without being willing to do the dirty work, I consider that a problem. I think that confuses the narrative, the language, and that's actually, that problem is what Batman versus Superman is about. Like, so I find it very fascinating that I appreciate your passion, I appreciate your perspective, and I appreciate your willingness to vocalize it. But one thing that draws caution for me is your willingness to not engage with it while still having such a strong, passionate opinion.
Well, it's funny what you brought up about what Inglourious Basterds is about. I feel like that's what it is. I feel like that it is a propaganda film. And again, there's, you know, a very, to me, unfun revenge aspect to that movie, just like Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. To me, I find it ugly.
Who were the real heroes?
There's no hero in that movie.
Well, here's the thing. In Inglourious Basterds, the bastards, America gets credit for winning the war. But in the film, in actuality, what was it? The German who allowed it to happen and made the deal, and the Jewish woman who will be completely forgotten because she died. She did it secretly and died in the process. Like the movie is not propaganda at all. Like that's the point of the movie. That's the very, very clear point of the movie.
A Jewish woman that actually had things to do. I will say that. I didn't find that movie sexist.
Well, right. And again, like again, accusing like the movie of being sexist, Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, Tarantino has more than proven that he believes in strong women, and like all of his female characters have either been definitive or iconic for the actresses who play them. But this is the first movie where Tarantino just lets a woman live, where he doesn't fetishize her, believe it or not. It's about how the world fetishizes her. But Tarantino is the only person that's ever allowed her to just be her.
I would disagree with that, because I would say there's enough feet shots for him to be fetishizing her in the film. So
there's equal shots of Cliff Booth. There's equal shots of Rick Dalton's feet. Everybody's feet gets featured in this movie like that. It becomes cute after a while.
Not bare feet, though. Not bare feet. I don't think I see Cliff's feet bare.
No one wants to see Cliff's feet.
I want to see Leo's. I mean, that's the thing. I do like Leonardo DiCaprio is fantastic in this. Dakota Fanning is fantastic in this. I will say that. Those are my two takeaways from this movie, that I do think that both of them are absolutely amazing in the movie. So,
but notice how he frames Sharon Tate's feet the exact way that he frames Pussy's feet in Cliff's car. And Cliff isn't buying into the sexuality of it either. And when she starts to sexualize herself to him, that's when he becomes disinterested. Like, again, it's all by design.
I forgot about Pussy. Yeah, I do love Pussy. And I didn't mean that way. But her character, see, the way I took it is that I felt that he rejected her because he hates hippies. That was my taking of it. Again, it just feels like a very, he does hate women as well. So, I mean, she's a hippie woman. So that's probably the worst of the worst.
He's amused and he likes her. He's amused by her. Like, he hates hippie culture because it's the end of his era. And so he builds up in his mind that what they're doing must be nefarious, like with this old man. But the old man likes her. Like, the old man is totally fine with how things are going. He's willing to accept that the old ways are dying off, that right. He's dying off. Like that's the whole point of that scene. There, like, Brad Pitt sees it as menace when really he's the threat to them. So, you know, but their inability to match him on a masculine level, you know, is what sets him off, and he beats the shit out of that one hippie guy. You know, it's about that bitterness, but and then having a shot of a quote unquote, you know, hippie-ish guy riding his horse to save the day, to stop the, you know, the toxic masculinity of Cliff Booth. Like, you know, I mean, you don't get more clear than that to me of what you're trying to say, that like the old has to die because things change.
Then they could have had Cliff Booth die. You could have had his character be killed by the hippies. Why give him his revenge fantasy, his hatred toward hippies and women, that we have to watch play out. And it's totally ugly. It's the worst that right. Tarantino's ever done as far as like violence on
violence.
Screen.
Right. And it cripples him. Cliff Booth ends the movie being carried away by minorities, taken off in an ambulance, crippled. Like, again, it doesn't get more clear than that. And Cliff, the problem with most...
He's the hero, though.
No, see, that's the thing. What is his last line in the movie? He says, "I try," right? Most people who have a prejudice, or especially this day and age, with the exception of extremists, but the reason why we only hear about extremists is because the media needs to sensationalize things. But most people who have a prejudice, whether it be against women, minorities, you know, whatever, they don't realize that they have a prejudice. They don't consider themselves hateful. They think that, you know what I mean? Like they don't see themselves that way. They don't openly hate things, just like Cliff Booth. But at the end of the movie, Cliff Booth gets taken away in an ambulance by minorities, crippled because he was not able to cope.
So then when the credits roll, then is the story that plays out is that this stuntman went crazy and he killed some people and everybody is sad for this hippie cult. Is that what plays out? Because if that plays out that way, then I would enjoy the movie. But we don't get that ending. If there was like a tacked on Taxi Driver kind of ending where that was the story that played out in media. But I didn't take that from the film.
Interesting.
But Cliff Booth is second to Rick Dalton. Like that's the whole dynamic of the film. Like Rick Dalton is the lead. Rick Dalton is the leading man. Rick Dalton is the one who has to go from like cowboy who's fooling himself to a married man embracing the feminine to have a career again. Like, I mean, it's the little girl that he meets who has integrity that reminds him of the integrity that it takes to actually do what he wants to do and Kate and commit it instead of just mugging dick around. And when he goes back to do a good job on Lancer, they very specifically hold the camera to show that there is an authoritative female feet walking out of the bar, because now there's a female perspective on set is able to achieve his level of great acting.
Well, he passes the baton to Rick, though, and Rick goes and gets the flamethrower. I mean, totally, I think that totally just nullifies any of what you're saying as far as the Rick character, because I think he gives in to the old ways. He goes and gets the flamethrower.
Right.
When you've already got somebody dying and drowning in your pool and he just overkills.
Right. I mean, well, it's the money shot. It's the big, it's what people want. It's the revenge fantasy moment. It's the one part of the scene that is like funny and silly and ridiculous where it becomes a movie again, when the leading man, like that's the movie you were hoping for. Like
no,
if he had flamethrown Charles, well, meaning like if he had used a flamethrower on Charles Manson, you know, you've talked about like,
I think you'd have liked it a lot more, Chad.
It depends. Cause the Hitler kill scene I didn't enjoy. So it does depend.
Right. Right.
I love
so
the
again,
kill scene. So.
Well, again, you missed the point of the Hitler kill scene. It's like, it's happening literally in the midst of propaganda. Two other people, Americans, take credit for it. Like, I mean, like that's like Hitler's already dead. They, you know, they may have been the ones that shot him full of holes, but they were only able to do that because the German allowed it to happen.
Mm-hmm. Well, I want to ask one last question and then we'll kind of get into some closing thoughts on this. But my last question is, I noticed a lot of people on like my Facebook timeline and Twitter and stuff like that, who didn't see it in the theater and then watched it for the first time at home, and in the middle of the movie are posting on Facebook, finally watching Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. Man, is this slow. I'm curious about you guys' takes on that, on this being a slow movie. What do you think about that, Chad?
I don't think it's a slow movie. You know, it's got some great moments in it. I just wish it had more. I think this is a movie that's about 45 minutes too short. That's my opinion. You could develop Bruce Lee's character, actually make him a person. You could develop Sharon Tate's character. I mean, I think if you take away the Rick flamethrower element, then I think what Joe's saying about the movie could more so work. But I think I think there's more to be explored than the film gives us. I think the film recreates the time period well. I think it does a lot good. There are a lot of scenes that I do like a lot. I do enjoy the scene with Brad Pitt and Pussy in the car. I do love the scenes at the ranch. I do love the Leo actually acting. I think more of that, and it would be a stronger film for me. I mean, maybe if we explore what happened afterwards, maybe that gives it a different aspect. Or if what happens goes in a different way, I think I would like it more. But yeah, it's not at all a boring movie. I mean, that's the thing about Tarantino. It doesn't matter what the movie is. I mean, Once Upon a Time in Hollywood is not boring. Inglourious Basterds is not boring. It doesn't matter what the movies are. His movies are never boring.
Mm-hmm. What about you, Joe? What do you think about that particular criticism?
Chad and I can definitely agree that Inglourious Basterds is not boring. Inglourious Basterds, in my opinion, is greatest American films ever made. Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, the reason why I don't think it probably works for people watching it at home is because when you watch things at home, we've been conditioned pretty much in general now to contain them. Like it's all like sensory overload. Television especially is designed to keep you like glued to the tube, you know what I mean? To keep you like coming back for more. This movie is not a plot driven or sensation driven movie. It's a thematic driven movie, which we don't get those kinds of movies anymore. Really. So at home, I don't see how this movie could work at all the first time. But that being said, my parents saw it for the first time at home with people who are trying to watch it at home. As far as, I mean, Chad was weaving in some of his like more like what I think were going to be closing thoughts on the film. And his hangups, like the idea of Bruce Lee being more of a fleshed out character, to say that, you know, I mean, Tarantino creates the perfect context for why Bruce Lee is portrayed the way he is in the film. It is Cliff Booth's resentful, angry memory of this guy that he didn't like. But then to ignore the other times we see Bruce Lee as informative, warm, helpful, and a key to others' success, like, is to completely ignore the whole point. And again, the flamethrower thing is to draw a parallel to World War II. And that is the parallel he's trying to draw to the end of the film when he torches a hippie in the, like, that's the whole point. It's supposed to be an awful because it's so far from what the reality of the situation is. That's the whole point. End of the day, it's about how Hollywood celebrates that and gives time and credence to that reality of a situation fits better into their narrative. Like the whole point of the movie. And if you didn't get it, you didn't get it. But that's not the point of the movie. And that content is, it's all there. And that is undeniable. Whether you liked it or not is fine. But what he was doing, what his point and purpose was, is brilliantly and meticulously put together, just like it was in Inglourious Basterds. Inglourious Basterds, though, had the benefit of being a genre film. So he's able to hit those genre beats for mainstream audiences. He's able to satisfy those beats. And it feels more like a fun, engaging blockbuster. Mm-hmm. This movie has the uphill battle to fight that he is decidedly going against that grain. And to me, that's a bold, daring move for him to make as a filmmaker. I really do. I don't think this is his best film. I think Inglourious Basterds is a better film. I think that Hateful Eight is a better film. But this movie is more me in a lot of ways than any of his previous works.
I think there's a lot of interesting points on both sides of this. I think this was a lot of fun to do. I think I'm going to have my work cut out for me with editing because of our connection problems today. But I'm really glad we finally did this. We'd been talking about it for quite a while now. As always, I just want to thank you two for being on the show.
Warning, do not listen while hungry.
Hi, my name is Stephanie Barajas, host of All Rice, No Beans, a podcast all about restaurants and the people behind some of your favorite spots to eat, where we talk about how they started, all the ups and downs, and my favorite part, the food and drinks. Ooh, and let's not forget about the desserts. So subscribe to Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. Also, follow me on all social media, because I have the pictures of all the food. And if you want to be on my podcast and you're a restaurant owner or in the business, email me at allricenobeanspodcast@gmail.com. And remember, you were warned, don't listen while hungry.
All right, so I hope you enjoyed that conversation about Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. If you enjoyed that, please let us know. We would love to know what you think about these kinds of special episodes that kind of break from format. We're going to do a lot more of this over on our Patreon, actually. We want to keep our main feed mostly all regular episodes, although, of course, we're going to squeeze in some like this every so often. But if you do want to hear more of this,
let us know. You could tweet at us at PiecingPod. Of course, join the Facebook group, Popcorn and Puzzle Pieces. You could email me. Our contact is on the website, PiecingPod.com. But yeah, we'd love to hear from you. You could, of course, also rate and review us on Apple Podcasts and Podchaser. Podchaser is a great way to get in touch, too. We're starting to really use that a lot more and connect with lots of our collaborators and other podcasts and all that kind of stuff. It's a fun site, so connect with me over there too, and that's a great way to get in touch with me. So yeah, we always love hearing what you think of the show, so please do be in touch. So that does it for today. Make sure you're subscribed for all of our upcoming episodes. We got Birds of Prey coming next week. We got Sonic the Hedgehog coming. We have our long in the can Jojo Rabbit episode, which has been sitting comfortably on our Patreon for all our patrons, but it's going to be hitting the main feed. I think it hits VOD the 24th, maybe? And so it'll go up that day. We also have Color Out of Space we just recorded, which that's going up around that time, too. That's when the VOD hits, too. So that'll be out soon. So lots coming your way. So please make sure you're subscribed to wherever you listen to podcasts. So let's leave you with a piece of music, as we always do. And I think a nice, fun, upbeat kind of track is a song called Head on Fire from my album Head Like Fire. So enjoy this piece, and we'll be back with more Piecing It Together coming up real soon. We'll be right back.
and all points west.
All right, we're rolling again. We were recording that whole time, but we're rolling again now.
So
now a car is about to hit Joe, I think.
You guys heard that?
Yeah, like loud.
I barely heard that.
I was telling David that I feel like I'm in Unfriended 3, the podcast special, you know, edition. And now Joe's getting hit by a car. So